Welcome to the Flight Test Podcast, everyone. I'm here with Alex. I just want to give a little intro to this episode. Today we're talking to Brendan Schulman, as most of you are familiar, and we do introduce him in the interview. He was Trappi's lawyer for the recent FAA case, which is on appeal. You can follow him on Twitter at Drone Laws. We didn't mention that in the episode. He posts lots of great articles and tidbits, and he's just a good guy to follow if you're interested in this sort of thing. We also recorded an episode with Trappi, a podcast episode.
Yeah, the week before Brendan got here, Trappi was here. We got a lot of good episodes shot, and actually one's going out today regarding the whole FAA reinterpretation law. Basically just stating we only have a week left to make our voices heard, so we need you guys all to go to regulations.gov and comment on the FAA's reinterpretation of model aircraft laws. It's a pretty big deal. Regardless of whose side you're on or what you think, we need people to make their voices heard, and there's going to be info in this podcast, info in the video that we're releasing today. So stay tuned for all that stuff. But we got a lot of good content with Trappi, a lot of great times with Brendan. Unfortunately, we couldn't hang out all together because they both have tight schedules. But I had the opportunity to fly with Brendan. He not only is he a very successful lawyer, but he's been in the hobby for like 20 years, and that's not just like a front. He's legitimately a hobbyist. A really good pilot, actually, too. And he loves this stuff just as much as we all do. And he mentioned a couple times, actually, that he has no intention. He does not want to make a living off of defending hobbyists. He wants to make a change for the better, and that's what he's setting out to do. So he's a pretty spectacular guy, and it was a good opportunity to get to meet him and talk with him and fly with him, too.
Yeah, he's very interesting, very well-informed, and we have about an hour of content. He basically said we can ask him anything we want, and so we did. Mm-hmm. And I think it went pretty well. So again, regulations.gov, you can search for FAA special interpretation of model aircraft, or you can go to podcast 35 on flighttest.com, and we'll have all the links and information for you there. So again, you can follow Brendan on Twitter at Drone Laws, and let's get into the interview. Okay, everyone. Welcome to the Flight Test Podcast. I'm Austin Fury.
I am Alex Zavada.
I'm Josh Bixler.
Hi, I'm Brendan Schulman.
Brendan Schulman doesn't need a whole lot of introduction. I think that most people in the RC industry are pretty familiar with him.
He's making a big impact for us.
But for those of you that aren't familiar, Brendan Schulman is a hobbyist, first and foremost. That's what he is here today as a fellow hobbyist. He's been in the hobby for 20 years, that correct?
Yeah, 20 years.
And is how most people are probably familiar with Brendan is his work with Raphael Perker, and also known as Trappi, with the FAA case where the Federal Aviation Administration basically argued the case against Trappi, and you were his defending lawyer.
That's right, and at least at the initial stage, we've gotten the case dismissed on the ground that there's no regulation concerning a model aircraft. Of course, as I think almost everyone knows, the case is on appeal.
Sure, absolutely.
And that's caused a lot of extra work for you, hasn't it?
there was another round of briefing, yes.
Which we'd love to get into some of the details of the case, A, to be nosy, and B, because just to see how it might apply to other hobbyists or other enthusiasts.
Yeah.
Well, we put out a Facebook post about Brendan and letting people know that he was going to be coming here and hanging out with us a bit. And it got a huge response.
Yeah.
There were lots and lots and lots of questions. And so Alex and I went through those a little bit earlier today and picked some of what I guess you could say would be the most appropriate questions to ask. We realized that Brendan isn't here to give legal advice, but is here to share his opinion as a hobbyist and as one of us, really, as people that are concerned about the FAA's actions and concerned about what we can all do about it. So I do have a few questions here we can get started with.
I want to preface one thing we do a lot when we interview people. How did you even get in the hobby? I want to find that out before we get all the other stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you get in the hobby?
No one has asked me that of all the interviews I've done.
Well, I want to know because
so thank you for asking.
No problem.
I've always loved airplanes just been fascinated by flight, I think, like a lot of people who are in the hobby, and always dreamed of having a model airplane, but never really got around to doing it. And then when I was a teenager, I finally one summer said, you know what, I'm going to stop in, go to one of those local hobby stores, see what it's all about. And I did, and they referred me to the local AMA field, where I got to meet the guys down there, got to see what it was all about. And back then, you know, it was glow engines, and it was actually pretty complicated, and as they explained it to me. And but I ended up buying my first plane, which is a Superstar, Hobbyco Superstar.
Oh, yeah.
That lasted the summer. I think the wing folded, and it ended up in a canola field. So
nice.
That was the end of that one, but I now have 20 in my garage.
Nice. There you go. Oh, awesome.
That's a good way to start. So what's your favorite to fly out of what's in your garage?
I've got this Jackal that it's a prop jet, and it does about 130 miles an hour.
Is that the orange one I saw in the background?
No, the orange one is the Sundowner. That one does 110.
Oh, wow.
So close.
Just 110.
Yeah, only 110.
Yeah.
So it's safe to say you like to fly fast.
I enjoy all the aspects, and it's a real dilemma. When I go to the field, I fly to a club field near my house, and I'm torn between, do I take out the quadcopter with the FPV? Do I take out, you know, an aerobatic plane, the speed, you know, something that's fast? I can never decide.
And ultimately, you settle for everything.
I always take two planes in case something is wrong with one of them. So I'll usually take out the Sundowner to do some fast flights, and then maybe something like a Visionaire to do some close-in aerobatics.
Nice. We have a funny scenario. When you're coming, we're like, okay, we got to get some planes ready. And we realize we're looking around. We have a lot of planes around us, but almost every one of them needs to have something fixed or addressed.
Oh, so good.
We got Peter out there. Like, okay, Peter, fix as much as you can, as quick as you can.
Oh, well, when you're done, you should come to my garage. I think about 15 of the 20 need something.
Yeah. There you go.
That's normally how it goes.
Yeah, I think that's a normal hobbyist garage.
Well, thank you for sharing your story. I'm always dying to know, because everyone has, it's always something pretty unique. Yep. So I'm happy you had a good experience and got into it. So now to the hardcore boring stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and we'd love to fly with you later, Brendan, so we're gonna try to get some things up in the air here.
Great.
Yeah. It's good to know that you like a wide variety of things. That helps. So I think really one of the main questions that I think that is worth talking about, so we'll hit this one first, I guess for people that are unfamiliar with the matter, we don't want to walk in just assuming that everyone knows what's going on. You know, what's going on with the FAA, what's going on with this interpretation, and I guess the follow-up question to that is, how does this interpretation affect the RC community as a whole?
So what's happened over the past few weeks is the FAA has issued a notice of interpretation, which purports to interpret a 2012 statute. So for background purposes, the 2012 statute was Congress saying to the FAA, please create regulations for unmanned aircraft systems, the kinds of systems that will be integrated into the national airspace system, basically flying at airports, high altitude, all that stuff. And through lobbying, the AMA was able to put in a provision to protect hobbyists. That's Section 336. That section says, basically, don't regulate the hobbyists who are flying model aircraft. That's to be left to community-based organizations like the AMA and perhaps others, and not subject to any new regulations. In the past few weeks, the FAA has sort of, in my personal opinion, turned that statute on its head in saying that if you don't already fit the parameters of that exemption for hobbyist model aircraft, then you're already regulated. And by the way, we're going to take a very, very narrow view of what it means to be flying a model aircraft. So there are five requirements listed in the statute. We're going to interpret almost each of those very, very narrowly and in ways that I think do change the hobby, whether you're flying FPV, whether you're flying line of sight. Perhaps the only thing not affected is control line. If anyone out there is still doing it, that's great. You're probably safe. But just about everything else is affected in several different ways. And there are four main ways that I think really affect everyone. And you know, number one is this apparent prohibition on receiving payment for flying a model aircraft for any reason at all or in connection with any kind of business. So everyone in the hobby knows that people get paid to test model aircraft for hobby companies, to do aerobatic demonstrations at events, to do model aircraft reviews for magazines and TV shows. There are sponsor pilots who are very inspiring. They're some of the best people in the industry to in terms of technological development.
Some even have a YouTube channel.
So I've heard.
Yeah.
Send me the link, please.
Yeah.
So apparently, under the FAA's interpretation of the word hobby purposes, and they go to the dictionary to define this rather than actually look at what the hobby is all about, they pull out a dictionary and they say, well, that's very, very narrow, and you just can't receive any payment at all. You can't even do it in connection with a business. And that's how they're going to define what it means to be a hobbyist. So they call into question payments to aerobatic hobbyists. And I just think if you know the hobby, you know that for a long time, people have been doing that, have been paid to do it. It doesn't make the hobby less safe, and it really is an integral part of what it is to be a hobbyist, to have the manufacturers creating these hobby model aircraft for us.
Yeah, there'd be no way to demonstrate it and demonstrate the abilities of an aircraft if you didn't have someone demonstrating it for them.
Yeah, I don't know how you would create a promotional video to sell your hobby aircraft unless you did the video in China or somewhere else. So there's a real threat to the industry in terms of forcing it to go elsewhere for product testing, for research and development, to find the talented pilots. Just about every aspect of the hobby at some point comes back to someone gets paid to do something with a model aircraft in the air. Otherwise, you can't have a hobby. So that really is a threat, I think, to everybody who's listening.
Yeah.
So beyond that, there are three other points that I think are really important. The second is this air traffic control issue. And going back to the 1981 guidance, this was the FAA's voluntary guidance, AC 9157, and there they asked model aircraft operators to notify the airport operator if you were going to fly within 3 miles of an airport. That was it, and it was voluntary. That has now been expanded to 5 miles, and if you do the math on the area inside a circle, I think you'll realize that that's not just 2 miles more. It actually is a lot of surface area out there.
It's almost double.
Yeah, exactly. And so what they're saying now is not only do you need to notify someone at the tower or air traffic control, but you need authorization to do that flight. And it doesn't matter how big your model aircraft is. It could be one of those micro blade helicopters, like the Blade Nano, which weighs half an ounce. Apparently, you now need to call up ATC, air traffic control, and ask for clearance to fly that in your backyard if you're within 5 miles of an airport. I don't think that makes any sense. I think it puts people in peril of fines if you don't do it and they subsequently object to it. Mm-hmm. I also think it's a tremendous burden on the system. I don't think air traffic control wants hobbyists calling them to get clearance to fly, a 1-pound quadcopter in a park.
They got more important things to do, like guide airplanes to the ground safely.
That's what I think.
Passenger airplanes with people in it.
And that goes all the way back to why there is an FAA. If you go back to 1956, there was a collision between two jetliners over the Grand Canyon, a horrible accident. It's never happened since then in U.S. history that we've had a mid-air collision of two airliners. We've had small planes collide, but never an airliner. And the FAA was created at that point to keep air traffic separate and to prevent that kind of thing from happening again. And I think that the FAA has done a tremendously great job at keeping us safe in the air. I flew out to Ohio to be on this podcast, and I felt very safe on the plane, in part because of the regulations. But it's very different if you have no one on board and the model aircraft weighs a few pounds and is being flown not in the path of airliners. To me, it's a different safety consideration altogether and shouldn't be subject to the regulations. And that really is what Congress said. Congress said, don't regulate, don't impose new regulations on this hobby, which is basically self-governing. The community can take care of it and has for many, many decades.
Yeah.
So that's point two. Point three is the FPV point, which I know you've discussed before on your prior show. That basically at least calls into question whether you can use goggles to operate a model aircraft using FPV on the theory or interpretation that when Congress said a model aircraft is one flown for hobbyist purposes within the visual line of sight of the operator, that within the visual line of sight wasn't just a distance, which is what it seems like to me.
They're literally talking about line of sight.
Yeah, it was like a mode of flight control. How are you controlling the flight? You actually have to look at it and control it. And I think everyone in the room here is an FPV pilot, myself included, and we know that FPV is extremely safe. You have tremendously precise control over it, particularly if you have a spotter standing next to you monitoring the airspace. So, for example, under AMA guidelines, that's how you're supposed to do it. And if you have someone looking out at the airspace and telling you what's there and whether you need to come down, you can come down. And there's no safety issue that I can think of with respect to the mode of control if you're flying within line of sight, which is close enough to be able to respond to air traffic and other safety type issues. And yet the FAA has said, really in a footnote, that even the AMA's guidance is now called into question. So if you're an FPV pilot or an aspiring one, or you think there's future in the technology for hobbyists, I've seen kids get fascinated by this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah,
it's amazing. That's an impact that certainly is out there and deserves comments, I think.
We do a lot of programs at school. We actually did it before even flight test existed. But one of the greatest things that kids loved would be when we'd sit them in a chair, put goggles on them, and then give them a ride. And we roll upside down, they grab onto that chair with all their might, you know, and it was one of the neatest things. But to give them a perspective that some of them will never have, you know, some of them aren't going to go up in a small private airplane and get to see their hometown from, 200 feet up. So to get that opportunity to them, it fascinates them and it makes them dream.
It absolutely. You go all the way back to Da Vinci and you can see sketches of people trying to figure out how to get into the air, wanting to be like a bird, having that dream to, you know, people would literally tape wings to their arms and try to flap off of cliffs, and they would die doing that because they had this notion that there was something majestic about flight. And now, not just flying from the ground, but for the past 10 years, you can put a camera on board and have that experience.
Yeah.
And it really is amazing and really inspiring. That whole aspect of the hobby is being called into question.
That's amazing. I can see the arguments that they're making about just FPV can easily be trickled over. If it's all about safety, that argument can easily be made by line of sight flying afterwards. You know, it doesn't really stop it there. If FPV went away tomorrow, they still have the grounds of saying, well, normal, you could still run into a full-scale aircraft flying line of sight. So why try to regulate it just on FPV alone?
Right, and that's actually leads to my fourth point, which is perhaps the most disturbing of all. If you read the very end of the FAA Notice of Interpretation, it's 17 pages long. It's hard to get through. It's a lot of legalese. But if you just look at the last few lines or the last paragraph, it basically says that if they identify a safety issue with respect to model aircraft, they can apply any of the existing regulations to that model aircraft. So it's as if the model aircraft, in their view, is already regulated, notwithstanding Congress saying hands off, is already regulated, and they could apply anything. And we don't know what that is. So, for example, you're flying line of sight, and you fly over the pits, over people, maybe inadvertently, maybe something malfunctions. Apparently, that could be considered an air safety violation now, even if you don't actually hurt anybody. Traditionally, that kind of incident, if it did hurt someone, could result either in an insurance claim or a tort lawsuit, a personal injury lawsuit. And those things get taken care of at that level, and you don't need the federal government to come in and conduct an investigation, use taxpayer resources to figure out what went wrong, especially if nothing actually happened, if it was a near miss, or even if it wasn't a malfunction or a near miss, just by the fact that you're flying too close to a building or too close to people. The agency has not told us how close is safe. And so in the absence of that, it's problematic to say they can enforce any existing regulation. We have the AMA telling us for decades how to fly these things safely, and people have been doing that under that community-based guidance, and that is what Congress intended for this hobby to be going forward.
Yeah, and the hobby's only gotten safer. As time goes on, it's amazing the redundancy now that you have in RC aircraft. Yeah. I mean, you could lose radio signal, and you have control boards on there that will self-write it and bring it right back to you. That, to me, seems like that's a level of safety.
Yeah, when I think back over the past 20 years, we started off with large gas-powered planes, AM radio, which was spotty and subject to interference. Everything was nitro-methane, so you had,
flammable hazards.
Flammable hazard, although really not. But so now you've got lightweight systems, batteries, digital radios. You've got telemetry back to the ground showing you your voltage. You've got stabilization system. So if you drop the radio, which, some people, once in a while, you drop a radio in the middle of your flight, your quadcopter stays put. And, that technology has made this hobby a lot safer. And I think, yes, it's true that FPV does allow you to go further or to places where perhaps you shouldn't be.
Yeah.
And that's something that people have to think about and really control themselves. And I think the hobby and community as a whole needs to think about what's appropriate and what's not. But that doesn't mean that there should be regulations on all this, or that the hobby itself should be viewed as more dangerous, because I absolutely agree with you, Josh, that it is much more safer. today.
That's great. Yep. That's great. And plus, back then, like you said, with the early gas and glow, average weight on a plane was anywhere from 4.5 to 10 pounds.
Yeah.
Now they're foam and about 2.
Right. And the AMA for a long time has had 55 pounds as the cutoff. And that, not coincidentally, is the cutoff for the small unmanned aircraft rule. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that that comes from anywhere other than that original AMA guidance. And when you think about it, I can't remember the last time I saw a 55-pound plane. But if you're flying 55 pounds, I think it's a different safety profile.
Absolutely.
Versus, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 pounds.
A lot more mass, a lot more energy, a lot more ability to do damage.
Yeah, safety is really relating to kinetic energy. So to the extent that you've got 55 pounds traveling at, I don't know, 50 miles an hour,
a lot
more dangerous than a quadcopter that weighs a few pounds and that is not traveling very fast because all it's doing is hovering around taking photographs.
Well, you know, and as far as safety and mass and everything, people don't realize you go to a baseball game and you're sitting really, really close to the baseline and someone hits a line drive straight into your face. I'd rather be hit by, I'm looking at a Park Zone radian, I'd rather be hit by a radian than a baseball to the face. Maybe I'm crazy, but the mass and the energy and the damage that's going to do is a lot greater.
And the legal point, I think, is what is the real danger and harm here that we are regulating? If you're going to have a regulatory state as we do, it tends to be addressed to particularly dangerous harms, dangers to large groups of people like automobiles, where if you swerve out of control or there's a problem with your brake system, you could kill a lot of people very quickly. Or things like medications and pesticides, poisons, right? We're talking about model aircraft. They weigh, you know, they're made out of foam. They weigh a few pounds. There's always a danger of anything. You know, it could be a golf ball, a baseball, a frisbee, and a model aircraft. But we've traditionally dealt with that using the tort system. So when someone gets hurt, there is compensation. Or even if someone's window is broken, just like the baseball analogy. It's not that there's no recourse to someone who's actually injured. The question is, what harms are we really trying to safeguard against? And if we treat all these flying model airplanes as aircraft, as if they have a person on board and they pose a grave threat to the public, then we're going to get overregulated. And that's exactly what Congress didn't want to happen. That's why we have 336 in the statute saying it's the community-based organization that's poised to self-govern the hobbyist as they've done for 75 years.
You may not be able to answer this, but what do you think? I mean, obviously, the government's putting a lot of energy and a lot of money into this. What do you think is their desire for that? Why would they pick this battle now at this time?
It's hard to say. I think they are planning to issue small unmanned aircraft systems rules in November. That's a schedule that slipped many times over the years. But even if it were to be proposed in November on schedule now, there's a 3-month comment period followed by DOT, Department of Transportation review, the Office of Management and Budget. It's got to go through the White House. It's considered significant rulemaking. So we're not going to see a final rule on small unmanned aircraft systems before 2016. And in the interim, I think the agency has recognized that there's an issue of lack of regulation. As the decision in the Perker case said, which of course is on appeal, but nonetheless, the decision said there's no regulation concerning model aircraft. There's only voluntary guidance. And I think that, you know, given that people are doing more with the technology now, both recreational and commercially, I think the agency felt compelled to respond just to what's going out there in the world. I don't know that there's a particular moment in time so much as, sort of a building pressure to do something. Both to move forward with respect to commercial uses, but also to impose some kind of regulatory framework.
It's you know, quite a crazy large power grab. That's what, you know, it's not just a little thing. It's quite a big chunk they're trying to take at once. And after their last defeat, you know, that you said is under appeal, I'm amazed that they would come back with something so large and egregious.
Well, you know, there's a lot of politics at play. Shortly after that decision, there was a hearing where Senator Feinstein asked the Secretary of Transportation to do something about the Perker case, and he undertook to respond with all legal means. So perhaps in part this is a reflection on that. However, I think the weekly headlines concerning privacy, concerning people who buy these systems off the shelf and don't have experience, don't do testing. They're flying everywhere. They're not AMA members. They're not starting off at AMA club fields. they're sort of doing it on their own right out of the store. I think that's where we see most of the problems today.
Yeah, so education could really be a big factor in helping that not happen.
Absolutely, but ironically, the FAA says you can't pay anyone to fly a model aircraft.
That means you can't teach anyone about model aircraft.
Exactly. So now they're relying on the hobbyists to teach each other how to do this safely, and at the same time, people can't be compensated for their time doing it.
Yeah.
And so to me, that's just a stalemate. How are you supposed to grow the hobby and bring people in for education if you can't be compensated for it?
Yeah. Very powerful. You know what? We have a lot of questions, huh?
Yeah, we do have a lot of questions. I think one that kind of follows the line of thought that we have been following, you know, I'm not asking for, you know, professional prediction, just kind of likelihood scenarios. What do you see as a likely outcome from this new interpretation?
Well, it's really hard to say. I know there are people who are talking. At the moment, there's a comment period still open through July 25th, and I'd encourage people, whatever you think of the notice of interpretation, and maybe you agree with it, that's fine. You should make your voice heard. The whole premise of the Perker case was that laws should not be imposed without consultation with the public. That's a fundamental principle of regulatory law. There's a notice and comment rulemaking process that's supposed to happen. And so one of the things I hope will happen as a result of this and the subsequent rulemaking is that people who care about the technology both commercially and recreationally will make their voices heard to the government, and hopefully rational minds will prevail, and there'll be some recognition that the safety risk factors for a 2-pound quadcopter are different from safety factors for a predator, a drone that's flying at 20,000 feet. So, you know, hopefully this is part of an ongoing discussion that I think has largely been confined to community circles in the past 6 months, has really branched out into the public. There's a lot of media attention now on the subject, and hopefully that dialogue will continue.
Interesting. Next question says, here's my question for Mr. Shulman. It seems the FAA prohibits the use of drones for business with quote-unquote safety, and that we need to quote-unquote we need to regulate everything as the arguments. But what is the real difference in safety between the use of drones for fun, for example, acrobatic flights over a farm, and the use of drones for business, for example, level flights to photograph a farmer's crops? They both seem to happen in the same airspace.
My personal view is that the safety framework is the same. The risks are in fact, are arguably greater for the hobbyist. I've seen a lot of professional photography outfits. They have a lot of equipment on board. They're very careful. They have checklists, and they're doing what they do in a very safe manner. They're monitoring airspace. They know where they are with respect to any airports, and that's fine. And a typical hobbyist may not be doing any of those things, or might be. It's hard to say. So the safety argument becomes blurred. I think that the question is very well put. What's going on, though, from the regulator's point of view is what we see in a lot of different industries. Once you receive a payment to do something, you're more highly regulated than otherwise. So, for example, I could give you a ride to the airport in my car, and there's no one who's going to say I can't. But once I start driving around town charging money for doing the exact same thing in the same way, someone is going to come in and say, well, that's regulated. I need a taxi or limousine license. In New York, the TLC commission would start to bug you about what you're doing. There's actually the taxi medallions in New York are worth millions of dollars. So there's a regulatory scheme because you are you're holding yourself out to the public as being for hire for a particular commercial purpose. And it's just a regulatory philosophy that once you do that, the incentives change. You might be more likely to take a risk because someone is paying you to do that. Or you might cut corners, or you might do something you shouldn't. And also there's a public trust issue, particularly with respect to aircraft. If you're going to pay money to get on board a plane, you want some level of assurance that it's safe to do so. They're taking your money in exchange for safe transportation. I don't think that really applies to a flying camera, really, but that's the regulatory mentality that really runs across the entire government system we have.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective. Let's see here. Kind of along that same line of regulation, most people feel that there needs to be some kind of regulations on FPV. What do you feel are appropriate regulations, and what areas shouldn't be touched by the government? For examples, altitude, distance, size, weight, power of transmitters, etc.
Well, I think the AMA has a pretty comprehensive and I would say even conservative framework for FPV operations. It basically involves starting off as a novice pilot with a buddy box or someone who's ready to take control if something goes wrong or you have concern about the flight. And then as you become more advanced, you need a spotter to monitor the airspace. And I think that really provides a safe environment to do this, particularly if you're at a club field. Those club fields tend to be known to air traffic control. They're in designated locations. There are set boundaries. You're not flying over unprotected people. And I think that at a minimum is perfectly fine and reasonable and safe. Where you go from there, it's really a matter of interpretation. I think if you have woods behind your house and they're yours and no one is there, and you want to fly around trees because you like doing slalom courses in between the branches, which I know a lot of people do and are really great at. There's some great videos of that. I just don't see a safety issue there. You're not up into navigable airspace. There are no aircraft nearby. There's no one on the ground to hurt. You probably know what you're doing if you're able to fly between branches. even though that kind of flight wouldn't necessarily comply with AMA FPV procedures, that to me seems pretty safe as well.
Wasn't one of the attacks that the FAA issued against Trappy that he was flying below tree line?
I think there was. Yes. One of the allegations in the complaint was that his flight was below tree level. Yes.
Yeah. So... I just can't believe, how do you present that as potentially being a harm to aircraft then?
Well, that complaint was puzzling because of so much of it concerned low-level flight that people would say is characteristic of model aircraft operations. So flying near buildings, I think there was an allegation about flight within 15 feet of a statue. There was an attempt by his assistant to catch the foam aircraft. I know lots of people are able to catch model aircraft by hand, and that's perfectly safe. You just flip the motor off, and you're fine.
Yeah. Similar to catching a baseball.
Yeah.
Probably less potentially dangerous.
Well, yeah. If people get hurt throwing the baseball around, again, there's an issue. Is this a federal aviation safety issue?
Yeah.
Or is it something else?
Yeah. I'm amazed also with the desire to for them to impact, blanket everything. I don't know how to properly say this, but you touched on it earlier. How can you safely instruct someone to get in the hobby and inspire them to get in the hobby where you can't monetize it, you can't instruct it? Because by definition, instructing people is going to motivate them to go out to buy something, even if you're doing it for free. You're technically advocating a certain product, and that's how business is. So... How deep can they go in this? I mean, basically what I see is everyone putting a plane up in the air is liable under their definition.
Well, everyone putting a plane up in the air is already liable in tort law if you actually hurt someone. The question is, with aviation safety is that doing something that might be unsafe and that could hurt someone could be enough to trigger a penalty. Yeah. And so the real problem is that it leads to all sorts of arbitrary interpretations about what's safe and what's not. And the FAA has not issued specific model aircraft guidelines. The only one who's done that is the AMA, and people have been following those safely for years. And that's the standard that was supposed to apply going forward. So I don't know why. Frankly, I'm puzzled. I don't understand why the FAA wants to take this on. I think they've got plenty to do. They're admittedly underfunded. Why they would want to go out there policing hobbyists who are flying per AMA rules. To me, the exemption in the statute was good for them too, because it put the whole issue of model aircraft really into the hands of the community.
Yeah.
And
so that means the community's resources had to go to regulate it, not their resources.
That's right. So, every crash of an aircraft or every aircraft safety incident is supposed to trigger a federal investigation. You know, the NTSB is on it. You always read about how the NTSB crash team is on its way. If people have to start calling up every time they land short at the model airfield, how much money is left over for the next gen
airplanes
or even the next gen air traffic control system?
They'll know us by a first name basis,
or by your nickname if you have a prominently well known one.
Altitude is something that's really interesting too. What's the legal altitude that full scale pilots should be staying above? Do you know?
Yeah, there's a provision in the regulations for minimum safe altitude of an aircraft, namely a manned aircraft. And that, generally speaking, is 500 feet just about everywhere in the country. If you're over a populated area, it's actually 1,000 feet, unless you're taking off or landing.
Yeah.
So, you know, you really shouldn't see airplanes flying lower than that. And I often do. And so one perspective you could have here is that this technology on the commercial side is so valuable that there needs to be room made. We need greater enforcement of pilots who are flying their manned aircraft too low, because that's actually the hazard that already is prohibited under the rules. And to the extent that those low-flying aircraft are what we're all worried about because the model airplane is at 250 feet and the manned aircraft are buzzing low to the ground for fun, it's the manned aircraft that's violating the regulations.
That's a really good point, and the fact that they're choosing to take a blind eye to that and use this as an opportunity to regulate where we're safely operating, you know, rather than saying, why are you in a 1,000-pound Cessna, you know, flying too low?
There was actually a mid-air collision 3 years ago in Colorado. I don't know if you saw that video.
I did, yeah.
Yeah, there was a biplane. This was an event with model aircraft and manned aircraft at a private airport, and someone was hovering a large 3D model right over the runway. And a manned biplane comes down with smoke on, with the show smoke on, and does a low pass buzzing the runway and collides with the model aircraft, which is completely obliterated and destroyed. The manned plane takes damage to the wing but lands safely, thankfully. I guess, you know, maybe it was lucky, or maybe the plane is a little bit stronger than the balsa. It's sort of judgment. but what was so interesting is what followed was an actual NTSB investigation, because there was a manned aircraft involved in an airport, and they didn't cite a regulation. They cited the AMA guidelines, and they cited AC 9157, saying you should give right away to manned aircraft. And ultimately, the NTSB faulted the model aircraft operator for that, who was basically just looking line of sight at the model. Even though I think if you watch the video, you might wonder, what is this biplane doing buzzing the field without making sure it's clear?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think there may be a predisposition to defer to the manned aircraft in scenarios where there's a conflict. And that makes sense. There's someone on board. We all want people to be safe when they're in the air. I'm not suggesting that a model airplane is more important than a human life. But to the extent that the conflicts are arising because the manned aircraft are not flying properly, that's something that should be of concern as well.
That's a good point. And theoretically, if they're operating according to their guidelines and we honor 400 feet or below, there's a 100-foot buffer there.
That's right.
Yeah, Trappier mentioned the, I think it was FAA law that occurred back in, right after the war, I think, something regarding warbirds flying low and scaring the
chickens
and harming the chickens, just to kind of like go insane and be unhealthy or whatever. And that was the point where the FAA did, you probably know the story better than me. He just touched on it just for a
second. Tell us about chickens.
Chickens are capable of unmanned flight.
I've seen it.
Can approve of that.
The chicken story, I think you're referring to a very interesting legal issue involving the right to airspace, who gets to use it, who gets to control it. If you go all the way back to the beginning of the history of the country, there was a doctrine that a landowner owned not just the ground, the grass, but also mineral rights, oil if you happen to hit it underground, and also air rights. You own the airspace all the way up to the heavens. It was a common law doctrine called ad coelum, just to throw in some Latin into the flight test.
You lawyers are good at Latin.
There we go. There was a big problem, though. 1920s came around. People wanted to fly airplanes, real airplanes, and for good reasons. And everyone wanted to do it. But every flight would have been a trespass because you were flying through what was considered private property. And so you create this potential for legal claims or injunctions or whatever. So people thought about, smart people, lawyers thought about, you know, how are we going to get around this legal issue? And it was a real problem because you couldn't just say, well, the right to airspace, the ownership of airspace didn't exist because we knew it always did. And we know today that if your neighbor builds something that overhangs your property line, you can get them to take it down or compensate you because you own that airspace, even if they're not touching the ground. So back then, Congress figured out, okay, we're going to say that there's a public right of transit of navigable airspace above 500 feet. And it's going to be based on that minimum safe altitude that you asked me about. So wherever planes need to fly as a matter of safety, down to the minimum, which is 500 feet, that's going to be considered public, basically a public highway. And everything below that, we're just not going to address, but we're going to give people the right to transit. So there aren't going to be legal claims. We're not going to provide Fifth Amendment compensation to landowners, which would have been administratively ridiculous and also expensive. But it nonetheless is required under the Constitution if the government is taking your property. So that wasn't the solution either. The solution was to provide a right of transit. In 1946, the chicken case, so these chicken farmers in North Carolina, the Cosby family, had government planes flying over their farm at 83 feet on landing to an airfield, and they sued the government saying, you know, you've taken our airspace. The chickens are literally getting scared to death, and that's a trespass, it's a takings, and they went all the way up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court agreed and said, even though the airway is a public highway up high above, there's still private ownership interest and private property rights in the airspace immediately surrounding private property. The airspace that you could use in connection with the land is still yours. And if the government is using it for their aircraft, that's a taking. And likewise, if someone is intruding, that would be a trespass. And I think the argument could be that if you want to use that airspace for some purpose in connection with the land, like you want to put up a flagpole, you want to set up a camera crane and do some photography from 100 feet, you don't call up the FAA for permission to use that airspace. It belongs to you. And, you know, subject to local zoning ordinances, you can make use of your property. So the argument, I think, that's unsettled is why couldn't you use a device that happens to use propulsive forces, propellers or whatever, to lift off the ground, to take that same picture from the same point in your airspace low to the ground? If you're below navigable airspace, you are arguably within the airspace that still belongs to you as a private property owner. And what we're seeing is the renewed value of this lower airspace. So for all these decades, air transportation was all about getting up into minimum safe altitude. You had to go up to 500. That was the whole value of your pilot certificate, was to be able to go from A to B at that higher altitude. But now we've got these model aircraft or drones or quadcopters, whatever you want to call them, that are becoming very useful, not just fun, at lower altitudes for farmers, for oil and gas industry, for property owners who want to sell their house.
Cell tower inspections.
Yeah, that's actually a great use. People actually fall off those towers and die every year just to get a picture.
We had a gentleman, Chad's house has a big tower. I'm sure you guys have seen it before.
I'm familiar.
And we got permission. The guys were climbing, and we said, hey, can we go up and film you? He's like, absolutely. And he was fascinated about the technology. And he goes, you realize when it's too cold, too windy, we can't climb these things. And yet it may just be going up to see if there's a little rubber boot missing on the top connector. And all we need to do is get a little rubber boot, and that saves the diagnostic time and the extra effort and danger. And he was absolutely thrilled with us. Like, aren't you concerned about jobs? He goes, no, it saves lives. And then there still has to be an operator flying that. So it doesn't eliminate jobs. It increases safety.
Absolutely. It's a disruptive technology. Certainly the jobs will shift like in every other industry. But I think you're absolutely right on safety. There are people who fall off those towers doing inspections.
I'm sure in the 1920s, there's a lot more horse farriers than now, you know.
and think about that tower, right? So someone put up that tower, however high it is, maybe a couple hundred feet or more. You probably know. You've probably measured it using your quad.
Maybe.
but someone built it into the airspace, likely without contacting the FAA.
Correct.
But for some reason, if you take your model aircraft up to the same location to take a picture for a commercial purpose, suddenly you're subject to airspace navigation, to air navigation laws, which is not what the FAA was set up to deal with. The FAA was set up to create regulations concerning navigable airspace, where people are transiting with passengers. And so there's a disconnect at the moment, I think, between what people are doing with these devices at low altitudes and what the FAA was really set up in the first place to address.
Yeah, very good point.
Well, I think we're going to shift gears here a little bit. So it's a fairly eloquently worded question. Do you think that if you lost the case with Trappy, that the FAA would not have brought this hammer down on the whole hobby like it is doing right now? And as worded by another Facebook member, did the fact that you kicked the FAA's tail play into the new rules?
That's some smack talk there.
as worded by a Facebook member.
Yeah. No censorship.
I would like to think that it's the lack of progress in rulemaking for the past decade that's the underlying problem here. You know, we've had an agency that has had the issue of unmanned aircraft systems on its table since 2005, and for whatever reason, a year ago decided they would pursue a penalty against a model aircraft operator who actually had not injured someone or caused any property damage. I don't know why they brought the suit. Or the penalty, I should say. I don't know why they didn't expect it to be defended if they didn't, or why they're surprised by the outcome. But you know, I would say it's the agency's obligation to create regulations that are enforceable, and it should not be surprised if someone who's asked to pay $10,000 out of their own pocket for flying a styrofoam model aircraft would actually think to defend against that penalty. Now, I'd say more recently what's motivating the agency is not the case, at least not completely just the case. There are people who, unlike Trappy, who when I took on the case, I knew to be probably the most experienced person in the world using this technology. I know he's always out there testing the radio frequencies. He's meticulous with the equipment. He has spotters. He contacted the helipad that you see in the video, and he had clearance from the helipad to do the flight. It was done completely safely, notwithstanding the dramatic video that resulted, which he's great at editing. What we see today are people who aren't hobbyists. They're buying these systems off the shelf. They're launching the same afternoon. They haven't gone to AMA to get any instruction at all. And I don't think they have any thoughts about safety or, you know, where they can fly or what the limits of the equipment are. And so, you know, we hear stories about people crashing into buildings, people launching off of balconies in Manhattan. It's those stories, I think, much more than the Trappy case that I think are causing concern. I don't think the Trappy case on its own meant anything without the sort of recent rash of people who are getting into the hobby, really not the hobby, just getting into the equipment for the first time and doing all sorts of things with it.
I have to say that I absolutely agree with you that the... you know, that it's not necessarily hobbyists that are the ones that are provoking this kind of regulation. It's the people that are outside the hobby that see something that's interesting or see something that's cool, or a lot of people, you know, just like the idea of having a camera in the air, and that's their appeal. And now for $500 to $1,000, that dream can be yours. And the correct education and the correct knowledge of how to do that is what's missing.
I'm fundamentally amazed at the fact that educating those people can be more of a crime than those people flying, though. You know, it'll be easier for them to prosecute companies that are going out there pursuing safe education about the technology, you know, because we monetize it.
And here's the thing from my point of view. For years and now, once again, the government is alienating the entrepreneurs, the technologists, the roboticists, and we've got people doing really amazing work. I go to these conferences across the country, and I see the technology people have put together right here in America, and it's literally ready to go. They're ready to help people grow crops, do environmental work. I've got my other case, which I completely can't explain, involving volunteer search and rescue, which apparently the agency thinks is also prohibited. So that case is pending as well. So we've got people who are out there saving lives, reuniting families with their missing loved ones.
For free,
volunteer humanitarian, absolutely, using a simple model aircraft, line of sight. It's not FPV, it's line of sight, camera taking pictures, stitch them together, and in 11 cases they've spotted remains, and in one case overseas they actually rescued two girls alive who would have ended up in the sex trade. So I can't understand what the objection is to that use and why the government wouldn't embrace that, people who know what they're doing.
And champion it.
Yeah, I mean, this is like American ingenuity at its best. You've got people in this country. You've got a huge community. You've got hobbyists who want to do something more, want to help communities, help industry. And rather than getting behind them and saying, wow, this could be like the next big thing for the United States in aviation, we're supposed to be aviation leaders, it's just the opposite. Don't do it. Wait a decade. We'll tell you later if you can do it. And if you're out there saving lives, you better not do that. You got to shut down. It's illegal.
I was amazed. One of the biggest things, you know, that we have to offer is food and resources. And the technology trap is explaining that, you know, we can use this technology to see problems 2 weeks ahead of time, you know, in the crops. Well, if you can address locally and deliberately certain problem areas, that means you're saving chemicals, you're saving your crops. That means you have more crops. That means you have more profit. More profit brings more taxes, but more crops brings more health and more abundance that we can bless other people with. I'm just amazed. I mean, I think the government would like to not give as many subsidies to crop farmers because they have bountiful crops, you know. I just don't get it.
Well, and it, there's an environmental benefit, too. If you go out to the fields, you'll see them spraying tons of chemicals.
They spray
from
everything
air.
Equally.
Yeah, and they often miss. So you'll end up with the pesticide on organic crops, and it kills them. Mm-hmm. And that leads to insurance claims. And environmental runoff. There's a big issue with farmers now in the EPA and navigable waters. And if we can keep chemicals out of the water supply and out of the food chain, that's great for everyone. We can do that with precision agriculture by spot treating places that need it. Or out west where there's an ongoing drought, you can take an image from the air and see which part of the field needs water and what doesn't. You can allocate your resources, your very limited resources, in a much better way. Yeah. That's just not an economic benefit like you're suggesting. Yeah. That's an environmental benefit.
Yeah. Crosses over also to people being able to continue to make a living. And if they can make a living, they don't need government subsidies. Yeah, they don't need welfare, you know. Yeah.
So I just had a curiosity. I mean, if with these innovative companies that are coming up with these technologies that are U.S.-based, you know, if they're feeling threatened by FAA regulation and they can't test their equipment, et cetera, I mean, what are the options for a company like this?
Well, it's hard to say. I do have clients that I'm advising, so I'm not going to get into anything specific. But one very depressing alternative is to go to Canada.
Yeah.
And I've had a number of companies.
Not that you hate Canada.
No, actually, I used to live there for a period of time. So it has a fond place in my heart. That's where my plane went down the first time. You didn't catch the canola reference, did
you? Yeah, canola. I was wondering, what is a canola?
Yeah.
I just didn't want to ask that question and embarrass myself.
Yeah, I'll tell you more about canola offline. In Canada, you can get a commercial permit in about 2 weeks.
Okay.
And because I think the view of the government there is, assuming you have a number of safety parameters set up in a reasonable way, it's a safe operation. It's a small unmanned aircraft. It's not going to kill anyone.
We were at Niagara Falls, and I saw about five or six multi-rotors just buzzing around.
Which side?
It'd be the Canadian side.
There you go.
Yeah. And the funny thing was, is there was an official there, and he had a biggest screen. I went up to a security person. And I had a multi-rotor. Unfortunately, when I safety checked that, I wasn't confident about my servo, so I didn't take it up. But I was like, are we allowed to fly? I'm like, heavens yes. Just keep it, you know, get it out over the falls. And if it falls in, you lose your, you know, plane. But the biggest thing was just put people first.
And I have yet to hear of, I mean, there are a couple of incidents that you hear about over and over again, and that's about it. All these people are flying around in places that are arguably objectionable, and I have yet to hear of a serious incident.
Yeah. Yeah.
So basically you're saying the main, even if an unattractive option, is to move your industry out of the U.S.
Well, look, I don't want to encourage people to leave the country I love, but, that's an option, and I know people are doing that. The other route is an exemption that the FAA says it will consider. I know there are filmmakers who've applied for that, and a couple other industries are trying it. There's no specific criteria for it, so it's a bit of a crapshoot. Like, what exactly am I supposed to establish if there are no rules or guidelines for what the exemption should be? Nonetheless, a number of companies are trying that, and the FAA says it will consider it. I think just as they're eager to impose restrictions on people today, at the same time they're also eager to show some progress in terms of commercial.
They want to be the ones regulating, but also the ones to get to show the hand of grace, which I don't think they really should have.
Well, so there's at least ostensibly a waiver type process. The other option is if you want to pair up with a government agency, to do government type work as a contractor, that's an available option. A government agency or a public operator, including state universities, can get what's called a COA, or a certificate of waiver authorization, that would allow you to use an RC plane or a UAS, whatever you want to call it, for not a commercial purpose, but for something like a government purpose, or at least an actual application in the field. And there are universities that have done that research. Arguably, it's unfair because the state universities have the ability to get that authorization, and the private universities who are doing just as much great work out there, potentially Nobel Prize winning type work in sciences and agriculture and environmentalism, don't have that path forward right now.
I'm speechless. That doesn't happen very often.
Well, we can't spend it all day in here. We definitely need to get out and do some flying. I do want to ask one last question that was asked on the Facebook. Isn't the FAA's current stance on FPV and RC in clear violation of Congress's intentions?
Well, as a lawyer, you can never say the word clear unless it's in a legal brief, and then you're just arguing the point. I think, as a personal matter, as a hobbyist, that if you look at the statute, the intent was to leave the hobbyists alone. And at the time that statute came out, FPV was definitely part of the hobby. It has been for 10 years. There's existing AMA guidelines, document 550. Concerning how to do FPV under their community-based organization standards. And it doesn't make sense to me that a statute that says leave the hobbyists to community-based self-regulation could be the premise for doing exactly the opposite and picking and choosing what types of hobbyist operations don't qualify. So in my personal view, not my legal view, it doesn't really make sense for there to be a restriction on FPV, given that we already have a community-based guidance for exactly that kind of thing.
And they've done a good job.
They have. I've been out to the AMA fields. So I've done it myself. It's very safe. You're flying in a very precise way. There's spotters monitoring the airspace. You can hear one of the things that is never mentioned or almost never mentioned is you can hear approaching air traffic, right? Which is something that a manned pilot can't do. If you're in the cockpit of an airplane, it is noisy. You need a headset, and you cannot hear the person next to you talking, let alone an approaching aircraft. You absolutely have to rely on your eyesight, or if you have air traffic control or something. But if you're down there with a model at the airfield, almost everyone at the club will hit the deck when they hear something coming, well before they see it. And the same thing is true of an FPV pilot. You can hear it coming and bring your model plane or your quadcopter down to the ground or to a much lower altitude below tree line before that aircraft gets even close.
Mm-hmm. Very good advice. Now, obviously the date's coming up quickly to make our voices heard. Why don't we just go over it one more time? Because we can't stress enough that you need to make your voice heard.
Yeah, absolutely. So regulations.gov and search for the FAA Notice of Interpretation dated June 25th. I'm sure it'll be on your website with a link. I think the four most important core points are this prohibition on any kind of payment or business activity concerning model aircraft. I think that just fundamentally changes what the hobby actually is, including flight instruction and contest, which I think many people enjoy as a hobby, even though it involves payment. I think this notion that we have to get clearance from air traffic control for any size model in our backyards and parks is just not the right approach for many reasons. The FPV restriction that contradicts the AMA guidance just doesn't seem right to me. And then that catch-all at the end of the notice that says, any existing aviation regulation may already apply and we can enforce it. I think that should be disturbing to anyone out there who's in this hobby, because that alone says we can arbitrarily, as an agency, deem that what you're doing is unsafe and come after you for penalties. And that ought to be of concern to anyone listening.
What's arbitrarily mean?
It means whimsical. It means you're sort of making up things as you go. You see something and you say, well, this doesn't look safe to me, so I'm going to propose a penalty. And then, unlike a traffic ticket where you can literally walk into court and it's a couple hundred dollars. And if you explain yourself to the traffic court judge, you might actually defend yourself. You don't even have to talk to a lawyer. These aviation penalties, as I think you can see if you've read the briefing in the Perker case, this is not simple stuff to defend. You're talking about administrative law. You got to file with the NTSB. It's paperwork. You're off and running. If you want to show that you were operating safely, you got to go to trial. Yeah. There's no real easy way to get out of it in a summary way the way that you can with a traffic fine.
And it's not the kind of trial that you have at a local court. It's a different kind of trial, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the witnesses, documents. It'll often take place at the FAA or NTSB office that's close to wherever you are, which could be hundreds of miles away. So it's not like going down to your local municipal courthouse.
Yeah,
it's a real burden just to defend yourself. And
on average, these fines that you're talking about, they're not cheap.
Well, Trappi's was $10,000 proposed. He never paid it. We defended it. The one imposed against the hobbyist in Manhattan, it was a proposed penalty. I don't know where it stands right now, but that's $2,200. So you're talking about thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
It's not a traffic ticket.
No, it's not.
Well, this is definitely a very serious issue, and we're gonna keep talking about it, and we're gonna keep bringing it up, and just like Brendan stated earlier in the podcast, even if you agree the new interpretation of the rule, please go to regulations.gov and leave your statement. This is about using your legal right to make your voice heard. Correct me if I'm wrong, the FAA is required, to, if not read every statement, to at least look at the amount of them, and see that, people have concerns about how this has been interpreted.
Yeah, they're supposed to read each one, and I think telling a personalized story about how this impacts you specifically is much more valuable than just cutting and pasting a form that you may see online somewhere. So
absolutely,
tell them what you're doing, why you want to do it, why it's safe. And if you disagree with what they're saying, then let them know.
And stay respectful.
Of course.
Yeah, and you don't have to, have a legal background to tell a story about, why, the model hobby is impactful to you.
Yeah.
All right, well, I want to fly a plane.
Yeah.
And if you want to access the links to that, if you're having trouble finding it, you can go to the podcast section of flighttest.com. This is episode 35. All the links will be there.
There you go. All right, guys. Cool. Well, thank you for listening. I promise in the future, providing we're not in Canada or moving to Canada, we will we'll have a little bit more uplifting content. But please make your voice heard. And thank you so much, Brendan, for taking the time to
thank you
to do this.
Yeah. My pleasure. Thank you.
You're very informative. Thanks, Brendan.
All right. Thanks for listening, guys.
Yep. See you next time.
See you next time.